You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 7th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
From crossing the front line to capturing the news-defining shot of battle, this week we've shaken up the format of The Stack to look at the changes impacting conflict coverage. Today we're joined by two veterans from the editorial floor, and we'll have a special report from Perpignan. All that on this 54th edition of The Stack. As civil war continues to ravage Syria, the U.S. is still trying to pull together something that vaguely resembles a coalition of compassion. In Egypt, a military coup and bloody protests set back any progress made after the Arab Spring. Iraq and Afghanistan continue to erupt with sectarian and fundamentalist violence. And Mali and Congo are far from putting arms to rest. In between the front lines, the editor's desk and the reader, listener, and viewer are the correspondents, photographers, sound technicians, fixers, cameramen, and producers. While they're in position to cover conflict, many are also fighting a battle with their own organizations for better resources, more column inches, and a few minutes extra airtime for better analysis. In a moment, we'll settle in with two journalists who have, between them, covered just about every war for the last two decades. We'll also be heading to the peaceful town of Perpignan to meet some of the photographers capturing the most iconic images of modern warfare.
I was raised with the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so this is where I found myself taking pictures. I have a degree in journalism and political science. I'm supposed to be writing, but actually my picture is my article.
All that and much more from our guests here on this special edition of The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brulé. As Syria continues to make front pages, never has been better to assess the quality of the world's war reporting, particularly when the world's two great powers debate who might have been responsible for chemical weapons attacks in that conflict. With more images and videos flooding pages and screens from eyewitnesses, citizen journalists, and NGOs, what role do traditional news outlets have in not only the process of editing, but also delivering their own images and reports? Today, I'm joined by two men around the table who know a thing or two about conflict coverage. And seated to my left is Stuart Purvis, broadcaster, who, of course, has been very much abreast of the spiraling events all over the world, former editor of Britain's Channel 4 News, editor-in-chief and CEO of ITN, as well as holding a senior regulatory role at Ofcom here in the UK. He has also just written a book, which we'll talk about in a moment, When Reporters Cross the Line, The Heroes, the Villains, the Hackers, and the Spies. In his spare time, he also manages to lecture on journalism at City University here in London. The students are almost about to descend back on campus, I would imagine. I want to talk about really, you know, the role of and really what sort of comes up as discussion points, because I've chatted at your school a few times as well. But first, to the book, a little bit of an intro about this. Starting point, and I guess as you were writing the book, even just everything that we'll probably be exploring in this program as well, Stuart, did you find that there was constant revisions as you went through the book? Or
I was pleasantly surprised to find that you could actually find new facts basically by going into the archives, particularly the British archive, the National Archives, where the British government filed away pretty much everything from the last century and has occasionally let things out. So if you take a famous writer like Frederick Forsyth, who's best known as a novelist, he was a BBC correspondent in the Nigerian Civil War in the 60s. His work for the BBC is actually quite difficult to find. What's rather easier to find is actually the British government's files on what they thought of his reporting and how they constantly complained to the BBC about his reporting, so much so that the BBC pulled him out. So I actually sat down with Freddie Forsyth and showed him the files. And I said, look, this is what the Consul General in Cameroon thought about you. And this is what the the High Commissioner in Lagos thought about you. And it was all totally news to him. So it was kind of it was new territory in a surprising way.
And it's an interesting approach as well, because it is told by, you know, many of the greats who have, of course, filled the airwaves and the screens in and of course, pages in this country as well. Was it was always going to have a UK focus, or did you, or is that the part two that you'll, the follow-up will be, you know, a cavalcade of international journalists?
Well, it's an interesting point, Tyler, because yes, it is intended for a UK market, or maybe perhaps a British Commonwealth market. But in writing it, I realised the different traditions of the UK and the US. The best example is to do with whether a correspondent should go into a war crimes tribunal and give evidence against an accused person. The British tradition, and it's not universal, but it is a tradition, is yes, you would do that. So some of the big names of British journalism, such as Martin Bell, have said, yes, I want to give evidence about Bosnia, or I want to give evidence about Rwanda. The American tradition is absolutely not. That is not what I'm about. And so maybe there's a book to be written about the different ways that different traditions come at this issue.
Mm. How much of it is a cautionary tale? Because interesting, you said, in many ways it was ever thus, whether it's with the BBC or other organizations. But by the time, and let's maybe not give it all away, but by the time the reader gets to the end of it, how many sort of warnings or signals are there for the horizon ahead?
Well, one reviewer, rather kind reviewer, said that in every chapter you could probably put yourself in the place of the reporter and say, what would I have done in those circumstances? And I don't, having, as you say, been around the block a bit, I think you have to constantly remember the power of competition between individual reporters and what that leads them to do. Mm. And I think quite often that's what's taken people over the line. I quote, for instance, going back to the 30s, the New York Times correspondent in Moscow, who was actually a British citizen, who had such a good thing going. That was a prestige post, that he didn't want to fall out with Stalin. So he just basically denied effectively what was a kind of Holocaust of its time, which was a Ukraine famine, because he didn't want to be expelled, because, why would he? He was the doyen of the press corps. So this the power of ego, I think, cannot be underestimated when you look at war reporting. Mm.
I'm also joined by Robert Fox, who, of course, is a journalist and a broadcaster, I think has been on the beat since about 1967, and is also a defense correspondent for London's Evening Standard. Welcome. Robert, when you listen to this, and I want to pick up on that point of ego, today, and we'll be talking a lot about just the role of citizen journalism. We see so many leaked images that come from the likes of NGOs, etc. Is there room for the foreign correspondent who has a bit of an expense account, who is able to, be deployed for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time on the trot on the newsroom floor anymore? Or are those days rapidly coming to a close, do you think?
The answer quite simply is yes. They have an expertise. It's the combination of luck, skill, experience, and really honed practices as well. And I'll give you an example just from today that you happen to bring it up. A colleague of mine, hugely admired, Steve Erlanger, who isn't writing about actuality news, intervention for poison gas but not other killings, tens of thousands died before chemical attack became a red line. And Steve, this is New York Times International Herald Tribune, in very, very little space, manages to go back through the whole sordid story since the first phosgene attack by German troops on the Allied lines in the Ypres salient in 1915, and does it with great elegance, with great skill, and goes through briefly the protocols and says, what are the problems? And they are very, very big indeed. Bloggers have a huge problem, which is only just beginning to be recognized, and you can see it in the really good online commentary. Universally admired is The Guardian's comment is free. But go through the strings on a hot subject and you find the same usual suspects, all arguing with each other and all drifting off in a tendency. It's funny enough, in this country, UK, the group that seems to have identified this, surprise, surprise, is the Tory party, because the Tory party has an open blog, but they're marginally to the right of Genghis Khan, most of them, and it's a useless kind of discussion. I think it is a game of all talents, and part of the problem is the quantity, the sheer volume of stuff that is coming out. On a crisis, a case, a battleground like Syria, almost all of it is of some value somewhere. Mm. But it's working out what the real value is and what the real value isn't is the real problem. And quite often that needs a professional mind, not somebody who follows the professional code, but he or she who has learned empirically the task actually doing it.
Mm. I mean, you use Erlanger at the New York Times and out of the IHT edition today as an example. If we would rewind 30, 40 years ago, would you have had in this country 5, 6 papers reporting at that same level? Could you reference as many journalists? I would sort of, you know, venture that we don't have that level of reporting across 6 papers in this country still.
Yes, we would have had an infinitely, it was a very different world. It was the Cold War, and the Cold War tended to recruit people with serious military experience. By the way, can I say, sorry, this is the thing that really gets me, is there is a tremendous dearth of military experience. I don't mean donning uniforms or being with formal armies, but it's the thing like my great friend John Swain, the kind of sheer experience he has at guerrilla war. There are people on news desks, and there always was. I worked BBC, The Telegraph, The Corriere della Sera, now defense editor at The Evening Standard. And there was always a buddy there who really understood what was going on. My half-lame, brilliant editor at The Corriere had gone all through the Algerian War of Liberation and really knew. He said, look, this is likely to happen. It's that background I don't have anymore. Mm. You know, whether you're phoning up the BBC or the Standard News Desk or whatever. Sorry. And to go back, there was I found an absolutely engaging, utterly charming editor of the Times, Douglas Hume. And he was probably the most experienced defense correspondent that I knew because, you know, when the tanks went into Prague in 1968, he was there watching them, counting them, understanding the Russian formations, and he knew it was serious before anybody else did in the British media.
So does this become the preserve of fewer news organizations? Does it sit in the hands of, you know, let's say, you know, a rapidly rising Bloomberg, which has a lot of expertise across a lot of sectors, and the New York Times? Or do you see that there are going to be special, you know, maybe more specialist pockets, and people might have to turn in, as often we do, to Janes and other people? But you know, is there room for the defense desk, or at least the defense correspondent, who's a true expert as well?
I think there are two different kinds of war reporting that we're talking about. We're talking about, first of all, almost about combat reporting, and then we're talking, I think, about analysis. I have a slightly different memory from Robert from the old days. My memory of the old days, for instance, I joined ITN in 1972, and 1973, as a young producer, I was sent to the Middle East war, and there were two ITN reporters covering the whole war. Okay, one of them was Gerald Seymour, who went on to become a thriller writer. And the other one was Michael Nicholson, who pretty much carried on doing the same thing for the next 20 or 30 years. And they just went from war to war. And they were pretty much the only people who did it. If you go fast forward to 2003, when I was the editor-in-chief of ITN, I think we spent about 15 reporters to the Iraq invasion and all its different knock-on stories. And some of these people inevitably had never been to a war before. So there's a whole generation of younger reporters who never had the opportunity before. Now, the upside of that is they're getting more experience. The downside is it was their first time.
Yep.
So we can't have it both ways, Robert. If we want people to gain experience, they will have to start somewhere.
I agree entirely, and I'm going to enter a load of caveats here. A lot of these people had military experience and were attached to the establishment. Mm. And there was the Defence Department, I think, in your and my day as we were starting, were colleagues then. I mean, I found it at the BBC absolutely irksome. I was in a thing in 1976, sorry. It is sort of war, but it really wasn't. In a ludicrous thing, round three of a thing called the Cod War, when British trawlers were getting close to Iceland and the Iceland Navy, such as it was, who actually was very effective, were cutting the lines and so on. I found it extremely irksome. I went up to the ice for a month's patrol, solidly at sea. But everything I did or said was being second-guessed by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And I was shocked when I came back, because I was then being moved up the pecking order and I was being duty desk foreign editor and so on, and that I would get the call from the Foreign Office whisperer in news department saying, this is not what we want. And I couldn't believe how that happened.
I need to ask.
But to answer your question about Jane's, I'm quite worried about this, by the way, because there are now...
I knew this would get you anyway.
Yeah, you know, there is a commercial interest with these people.
Sure.
Some of them are very expert, but some of the very experts are very narrow, and they're selling a product. Every time I write a column in The Standard, I get an avalanche of emails. Right. Would you like to buy from our expert? No, I jolly well wouldn't. I'd like to interview him. I think there's also one thing that I'm embarrassed to say. I'm 68 in 2 weeks' time. I am still in demand because I'm the in-between character, between the characters. And you're absolutely right, the people you want to train, to bring on, to send out, and the people who have a vested interest, whether it's from government, whether it's the military, and whether it is something like Jane's, which is a commercial outfit. And for me, it's a free fire zone, journalistically speaking, at the moment.
Now, I can't let you go on this one. I have to go back. Would you say that you were probably, you know, one of the only or the only embedded journalist or the first ever embedded journalist in a Cod War?
Oh, no, there were loads of us. I mean, but it was the agricultural correspondent, Archie McPhee. But at least I got onto a frigate. He got onto a trawler or a tug and was seasick for about 35 days on end. Yeah.
Stuart, I want to ask you, when you look back and if you're, you know, able to go back to the early days of sending two correspondents out to the Middle East versus the 15, How did the narrative differ when you looked at Iraq versus what was, I guess, being sent in on film, you know, back in the early 70s?
Well, the 73 war was actually, what was the first television war is a kind of endless discussion. But actually what was interesting about that war was that the UK and US networks flew in a mobile film processing plant. Because up until those days, and this is amazing to think back, what would happen was that the correspondent would go out, and this happened particularly in Vietnam, film for the day, go back to base, put it on a plane, it would be flown somewhere, they'd record a commentary. They never chose the pictures that went with the commentary. That was done by a film manager in Hong Kong or San Francisco or somewhere. Then suddenly, in the 73 war, Jerry Seymour would come back from the front line. I would sit with him. We'd make the piece ourselves. And suddenly correspondents were kind of empowered. And at that moment, I have to say, they all complained about the amount of work it required because they rather used to like going off to the airport, sticking the film on the plane and then going out to dinner.
Right.
Now they'd come back and sit with boring producers like me and say, let's move this bit here and let's change this bit here. But it did give them, the US networks have something called script approval. Even to this day, I've sat with American correspondents. Mm. They write the script, they send it to New York, and it comes back completely differently. The British tradition is let the Martin Bells of the world say what they want to say within the rules of impartiality. Mm. So I think the new technology, and it goes back to 73 really, has given reporters more freedom. The question is how they use that freedom. Mm. And to that, you know, this division between, say, the front line and the analysts, I think the really interesting thing that what people like Robert have brought to it is an understanding of the military machine. It is the contacts within the military. Not to be, in a sense, sign up, wear the uniform, as some people have done from time to, but just to bring that expertise. And what I really hate, Tyler, is the people who pretend to have that expertise and don't. And this applies to journalists and also to politicians. I mean, I think one of them would probably go on to talk about, you know, the recent wars. I think it was, if you take government ministers in Britain who suddenly were put in charge of armed forces, had no knowledge whatsoever. And started talking about, I've been in theatre, this wonderful sort of military phrase, which means nothing to most people. And so I think some of the mistakes that have been made in Western adventures the last few years are partly down to politicians who don't understand the military as much as journalists. Mm.
Gentlemen, we're going to take a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here at Monocle 24, talking to Robert Fox and Stuart Purvis. Back in a moment.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service, based in the heart of London with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries. We broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with the stack here on Monocle 24. I'm joined by Stuart Purvis, his new book, When Reporters Cross the Line, just out, and Robert Fox, defense correspondent at the Evening Standard here in London. Stuart, you're talking about, when was, and you said it's a debatable issue as to what was really the first televised war. And you were comparing and contrasting, how the U.S. do it, script approval, et cetera, versus how it's done in this country. Let's go back to the sense of live, because, I feel so often now, is it filler? I know satellite time is very expensive, but we get a lot of stand-ups on very nice rooftops, and we might have Jeremy Bowen talking about suburbs of Damascus being shelled, certainly as I was watching last night. He's referring to suburbs 4 or 5 miles behind him. And this takes up, an extraordinary amount of time in a 30-minute news cycle. But if we rewind a little bit, was it the Americans who pulled this out of radio, or was it the Brits who started filling up more time? At least, I guess in those days, it would have been phoners.
Yes, I mean, there's always been a tradition in radio, particularly of the vivid live report done on a telephone, or what used to be called four wires, which were kind of upgraded telephone lines. So they've always had value. But I suppose it was the sort of 24/7 news outlets, whether they be television or radio, who created this demand. Now, you say that sort of satellite time is expensive. Well, it used to be, and you used to buy it in sort of 10-minute nodules, and you tried to cram everything into that 10 minutes. But, of course, with the arrival of new channels, broadcasters began buying whole 24 hours worth, almost pre-booking it, waiting for wars to happen. So,
good news for Inmarsat.
Good news for Inmarsat. But then, having paid that fixed cost, well, why not the hell use it for hour after hour of people talking? And then you create these two different classes of people, the rooftop reporter and the frontline reporter. Mm. And sadly, they have become almost different roles. And it's probably, there are people who became famous for not being on the front line, but on the aerial time. I mean, going back to the first Iraq war, the man who became known as the Scud Stud. This was a young Canadian reporter.
Mr. Kent,
who appeared, I think, on NBC. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Kent is an attractive guy to female audiences. And I think it was George Bush's wife, Barbara, who said, who is that man? Mm. And he just became a complete phenomenon. The same thing happened around Raggy Omar of the BBC. And with respect to these people, they were doing the job they were assigned, but they hadn't actually been away from the rooftop. And what I find compensating for that is that you do still have the correspondent who goes to the scene and then gives you a crafted piece. I mean, one I would mention is a chap I recruited to ITN called Bill Neely, who's on the air the whole time now from Damascus, both on BBC and NBC. He just thinks about his piece, he polishes it, and frankly, that's what win awards. But I don't deny the craft of the Christian Amanpour of the world, who can just stand there and talk for hours, All I would say is I don't think Christian Amanpour has ever won an award for a kind of 2 or 3 minute report over picture that says it all.
Mm. Robert, I imagine that you might have an issue with the rooftopper who you know, and in many ways, you know, probably you know, some would argue they're the filler crowd as well, because they have to fill out satellite time, versus someone who has to go out and craft and work with his producers, cameramen to create a great narrative.
Yeah, but this is also where print comes in, and it's where print really should be effective. And too much of print has the Michael Herr effect, as in Dispatches, and they write it as if it's a TV or radio commentary. Mm. And that is not really their strength. It is the kind of Steve Erlanger being, oh, finding that bloke or that war criminal, and really forensically going through it. And this is performance journalism. And the awful tag, of course, is the dish bitch, that they're chained to the thing, that they do God knows how many things, and they're not really reporting the news, they're commentating the news. Now, talking about the Scud stud, you see, fulfills Stewart's criterion. Very early on, he was reporting from the roof of a hotel and said he was absolutely beside himself. He was almost orgasmic, I would say, because he saw 4 RAF jets going into bomb Basra, and he reported that live. And guess what? In the Basra box, they'd had their air defense radars taking out, and they were watching him, and they were ready for him. He was unwittingly, the journalist had entered in entered the battle space. But the thing that I would say also, it is a great skill, it's not just war reporting, is actually commentating, doing a rolling news story. No names, no pack drill, as the military would say. But actually, and I watched it across channels, the coverage of the chase for the Boston bombers, or alleged bombers, was absolutely dreadful because they didn't have the skills. And we've got the skills. Mm. I mean, the guy, I know it was, but it was as live, Ed Murrow, famously watching the Blitz from the roof of Broadcasting House. It's like really good sports commentary.
Mm.
Say what's going on in front of you, and if there is a lull, give a resume as to who's got what and was where, and what so-and-so had anticipated, what went wrong, back to the action again. You've got to roll it forward like that. You've got to be a good talker. You've got to have very good tongue and brain coordination, and not everybody has it.
It wasn't part of the problem, and I don't want to dwell on Boston too much, but here you had a very local story. You have a city which, yeah, maybe with some of the U.S. networks, they do have national correspondents there still, but this is, you were relying on the resources of local channels, of course, in a very, very big market, but then it also became an international story. Everyone went live with this. And so do you think that's why it came across as slightly amateurish, because it took time to get people on planes or drive up to Boston? You know, the BBC must have had a massive deployment out of, you know, Washington and New York to get people up there. And they looked really back-footed amongst the major broadcasters.
Yes, I suppose the biggest problem with Boston was the truth, because, yeah, you know, I have never seen news organizations get a story so wrong. Yep. And it's, you know, slightly awkward to pick up one, but CNN tried something in some ways innovative and revolutionary, which was location-based presenting. Now, we're absolutely obsessed in broadcasting with location-based presenting. So, you know, anchors are flown.
I hadn't noticed.
anchors are flown all around the world to say 30 seconds in front of Bill Neely's piece or something like that.
Cairo has been a very good case in point.
Very good.
Poor
case.
Souls, they've looked absolutely lost.
But on Boston, and it's a conflict, as it was not a war, but what they tried there was to, in essence, do the whole story standing in the street. And so you actually had people making phone calls on air and looking at their emails on their phones on air. Now, in some ways, that was quite exciting. The trouble was, they didn't get the story right. I mean, had they got the story right, that would have been a very positive celebration. So actually, there's quite a lot sometimes for having the presenter in a cool, calm studio with all the sources available to them and people around them who are able to help make judgments.
Mm.
But actually, if you've ever stood, and maybe you have, Tyler, stood in the street with maybe even 2 earpieces, listening to a person who's talking to over traffic noise, looking at a smartphone, it's just a kind of not a very sensible place to make measured judgments.
No. I want to just talk about being present. And I was at a conference, it was a digital conference in Germany a few years ago. And your point about bloggers, Robert, is an interesting one, because someone beat up the head of a big media organization and said, why do you spend all this money on the correspondent being there when in fact you have 10 bloggers sitting in Basra? You have them sitting you know, there's sitting in the middle of Baghdad, bullets are flying around, and they're present. You know, why don't you just, you know, rely on them? Why do you need your star correspondent there? Now, of course, there was a very fine rebuttal, but it was amazing how many people in the room were nodding, going, yeah, you know, we don't need that person. We don't need the glamour stand-up.
How many had been in a street battle?
Precisely.
So street battles are very difficult to fight, as well as report.
From your sofa?
No, but they're very difficult. You know, when you put two or three units down, they nearly always end up shooting each other.
Mm.
But and it's very interesting what goes on in the psychology of perception. Can I draw attention now to my
yes.
favourite newspaper? But it's not from that paper. The wonderful ex-monk, brilliant Professor James Carroll. Do look at his piece, The Data Mine, which appeared in the IHT, but I guess it was in the Boston Globe, around September the 3rd. And we have got, as Stuart says, this wall of information. And it's sorting out the good from the bad. Now, to take your point, there's a great friend of mine who I haven't seen for years, but he was a brilliant, brilliant reporter. He could report things of great national and international moment as if it was local. And it's John Kiffner. John Kiffner was your beat cop reporter. I believe his dad was a New York cop. And he did the killing of Arkan, for example, the well-known militia leader. He just got the local context of what this guy, monster to us, hero to his adoring followers, and did the setting. And OK, it was in print, but it was a live commentary in print. And there was a lovely piece he did going back to the Bronx where he'd grown up and reporting it as a foreign country. It'd say, I'm sorry, there is something in this where there is innate skill. For somebody like myself, I may do it very badly. It's rather like Dr. Johnson and women actresses and dogs performing or whatever, but I do it. And it took me years to realize that there's some gene in me. I was a reporter, born, not made, to nose around, be a pain in the ass, cause trouble, kick tables over. I want to know what happened. Now, talking of Bosnia, which was a very live TV and radio war, but my great colleague and friend, Ed Vulyami, of The Guardian, and made his international reputation, and quite rightly out of this, went off for days really finding out what went on in Amaska and all these terrible camps and so on. And I think it's hugely exciting. It's all complementary. And we do pick stuff from each other's skills and disciplines. Mm. I do not regret that I spent almost half my life as a staff correspondent on radio and a bit on TV and then went to print.
Mm.
They're not the same thing, but they do talk to each other very well.
Mm. Stuart, do you think maybe the debate is changing and it's drifting, hopefully in a more positive direction, newsrooms, that people sort of realize citizen reporting, great. You know, it's wonderful that you can have some armchair analysis, you know, but it's just that the 10 bloggers who are sitting in Baghdad, they still have to comment on what they're reading on AFP, Reuters, what all of those people who are really out there doing. They're not actively out on the street, more often than not, anyway.
It's interesting. For both bloggers and mainstream reporters are sometimes in a bubble. They can't move, physically constrained by the action. They can offer you what they can see, and that has value. But when they project what they can see onto the bigger picture, that's when you get into trouble.
Mm.
Because frankly, they, you know, for understandable reasons, they're not in a position to make a wider judgment. But that doesn't devalue what they as eyewitnesses are telling you. So where bloggers and citizen journalists are wonderful is capturing the moment and sending that moment to the outside world. Where they go wrong is trying to offer some wider viewpoint based on this very, very narrow sort of instant photograph they've taken.
Robert. And the bloggers really did come to a come of age in Iraq, because you get Salam Pak's brilliant, telling you what it was like to be on the receiving end of an invading army coming in. You've got Riverbend. But the most as interesting is Sergeant Kayla Williams, Love My Rifle More Than You. This rock chick who put herself through the army to pay for her college education. And she was obviously very smart. She did an immersion course in Arabic. She was a frontline interrogator. The US military authorities took a year to catch up with this. She was writing three times a week a blog diary, and she knew when things were going wrong. And by the way, it wasn't Cy Hirsch who first mentioned it. She is the first one who mentioned Abu Ghraib.
And it is, Stuart,
absolutely your point. They are immense and very important. They are valued contributors. They're a valuable part of the team. But when you ask them for an overall judgment, well, you might as well go, it's as valuable or not, in the, as the case may be, as what the man over is telling you over the port in All Souls College, Oxford.
And we must remember this issue of authenticity. Let's not forget, was it the gay woman blogger in, was it in Syria?
Yeah.
Who turned out to be a man in Edinburgh?
Yes.
that's,
One interesting point, and it's incredible listening to both of you, Robert, is this notion of recall, and I can just sort of think of the images when you're talking about Boston as well, Stuart. You have people sitting on their smartphone, you know, trying to sort of gather together facts. You know, is one of the challenges when you go into the classroom right now as well that there's been an this is a whole other program as well, but an evaporation of instant recall. That everyone just goes to the laptop immediately. No one even forces themselves to think, well, you know, what happened in 1943, you know, in the Pacific with the Japanese? You know, can anyone actually talk, you know, name who made the zero? Whatever it may be, it's all right there. And if you're going to be on the hop, on a rooftop, wherever you are, you really sort of need it. You need to know it.
Yeah. Now, you go first.
Well, I think the concern I had at one point was that young journalists didn't realize where news came from. They thought the news came from computers. They thought you sat there and this stuff comes at you. And I suppose, in a sense, the extraordinary development of Twitter has kind of almost, you know, reinforced that.
Yeah.
You can just sit with a smartphone and feel that you are one of the best informed people in the world, and probably you could be. So, in a sense, what one wants them to discover is not just the kind of, you know, the need to go and, you know, boots on the ground is used in a military context, but actually it has value for young journalists to actually go to locations. But actually, as you say, the sense of history. I mean, often the calls I get to appear on TV and radio programs, they just want to, they want somebody who can remember a bit.
Right.
So, you know, I can go back where Robert was in the Falklands. I can remember, I mean, my role in war reporting for the last 30 years has been sending people rather than going there myself. But I can offer some wider perspective. And that is, you know, sometimes at a premium in a very sort of instantaneous snap judgment world.
Mm. Robert?
Yeah, I invoke my friend, and I don't always agree with him, Robert Fisk. But Robert, some time ago, who was a wonderful writer and quite a serious historian and has a PhD, wrote a rather lovely piece about, you know, how you've got to have one history book in your knapsack. He's got a very good memory. I'm a historian by training. I did medieval history. I knew about mafia societies in Italy. I have done the whole skein of medieval to modern history in Europe very, very superficially. You damn well need to know about it.
Hmm.
The fact is that Steve is talking about when do conventions come in. Excellent piece I was going to bring up in History Today about the true legacy of the Battle of Waterloo, which is when conventions of the kind of thing we're talking about on gas really began and how it all went wrong. And in fact, one of the things that I'm obsessed with at the moment, because one of the honorific things but it's very time consuming, I'm a commissioner for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And that is where the distortion of memory and myth is a colossal problem. What really did happen? Who really did say this? You know, lions led by donkeys was not a quote from the First World War. It was a quote from the Franco-Prussian War and so on and so forth. I would want a serious correspondent in military affairs and security affairs actually to know this, to have a hell of a lot of it in the memory house of his brain. Sorry, this is the thing I do teach. Can I just have a 30-second riff on memory houses?
And then we're going to go to a break, but yes.
A memory house was a thing that the Jesuits particularly did because you're not going to be able to take all those books with you. There was a follower, Francis Xavier and Loyola, called Matteo Ricci, and he had the structure of these books in his head. You have to have your memory house. And Tony Judd, sadly, the great historian and commentator, as he was dying, built his own memory cabin, as he called it, because he couldn't read books, he couldn't access books, and he arranged what he remembered of his books in his head. A good international reporter really needs to do that.
I think that's a great DIY project for all of our listeners of a Saturday here in London. You're listening to The Stack. When we come back, we're heading off to France to the Photojournalism Festival.
Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with a stack here on Monocle 24. We're talking to Stuart Purvis and Robert Fox about conflict reporting and many other things. Gentlemen, last week I was talking to Jean-François Loire. He, of course, runs the Visage pour l'Image International Festival of Photojournalism. One of the things that we were talking about last week, and we'll go to another report in a second, was just this idea of accuracy. And of course, you know, you have this surge of video or still images coming into newsrooms and wire services all over the world. But of course, you know, we don't know where they come from. Just before we go to the piece, do you think there's more or less vigilance when you speak to peers now? Or is it just, I've got to get that image first, and are the same levels of checks and balances? When you talk about script approval with US networks, is an NBC newsroom any better than a BBC newsroom?
I think so, but I have to say that London has emerged as a sort of as the clearinghouse for this video, and it's down to the judgment of individual people, and most of them working for British networks or British news-based news agencies. But I do wonder sometimes how people who are not in this chain decide whether this stuff is authentic or not. I know it's difficult enough for the experts to decide. We have not yet had a massive hoax, but I feel we're always on the edge of having a massive hoax.
Robert.
Phone-ins from conflict zones. The filters are not strong enough. I do a lot for the BBC. And it is, again, the James Carroll thing. It is the sheer quantity. I do a lot on the news channel. The resources are very, very thin for checking the stuff. So
you're talking about, you know, potentially, yeah, the girl in Damascus in her bedroom.
But a lot of the stuff for the insurgents was coming out of Istanbul and was concocted, as we now know, on YouTube. And it is very difficult to know. You need such a skill set to know exactly even who you're talking to amongst the combatants in Syria, for example.
Let's go listen to this report. We sent David Pleasant down to the festival earlier in the week to find, of course, what makes just for great war reportage, but more importantly, who's prepared to pay for it these days.
The first week of Visa pour l'Image, the International Festival of Photojournalism, is fully underway, and the streets and squares of Perpignan are awash with people who buy, sell, or simply take photographs. A quarter of a century of existence comes at something of a threshold for the industry. Momentous news and ever-escalating conflict in the Middle East are driving the demand for current and thought-provoking imagery. And supply has similarly gone into overdrive. We're all photographers now, and we're all able to publish, or so the theory goes anyway. I'm going to go into the festival's hub, the Palais de Congrès, to look at the state of a much revered, if undervalued, commodity, the photojournalist.
So I'm Hugh Pinney, and I'm the Vice President of News for Europe, Middle East and Africa at Getty. Visa is a gathering point for the photojournalist industry, and it's a rare occasion where you will get publishers, you will get agents, you will get photographers. It's a giant meeting point, and it's a chance for photographers particularly, I think, to meet people who are, generally speaking, faceless names on the end of an email or potentially on the end of a phone, and to tout their wares, but to tout their personality and to actually look for means to further their own businesses.
When you're looking for new talent or established talent, perhaps, what do you go for?
In circumstances like this, you're looking for, on the one hand, the diamond in the rough, the undiscovered talent, somebody who is demonstrating that they have the flair, the talent, the skill, the bravery, the exclusivity, that little je ne sais quoi, which just brings their photographic work to life in a way that you may not have seen before, or somebody who has a different look, a different perspective on world affairs. And I think there are so many different approaches here, different people with different viewpoints, that you do get that broad cross-section.
And what kind of talent is available? With dozens of exhibitors spread out in Perpignan's ancient cloisters and churches, and some 4,000 photographer and industry insiders taking part, for 1 week this town is a mecca for those who make current affairs into a visual product. One such person is Phil Moore, who we meet at his show of photographs that capture the conflict between the M23 rebels and the government troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
For the first month that I covered this conflict, possibly on 5 different occasions, I tried to actually meet the rebels. The government and the army at this point had strictly forbidden any journalists to go and meet the rebels. So there were, you know, on 5 different occasions, I drove through government lines with a fixer and a driver to try and meet these guys, and each time we were blocked. Some of the images that are in the exhibition come from this time. There's a particular couple who lived between the two front lines that we visited in a village that had been completely deserted and then been left there. And it wasn't until July of 2012 that I actually managed to get over to the rebel side for the first time. I think the situation right now is that often it involves a kind of dedication and a sort of financial investment on the part of the photographer to go and cover a story. So often I will fly myself out to somewhere like Congo, hoping the work will come through. But being there, producing work that interests people, does have an interest in the industry. I mean, it's great to see that Congo is recognized here. I mean, this conflict has been covered by many, many great photographers, but at times there's also the feeling that it's a forgotten conflict. And I've seen how, through working with AFP, images are put on the wire, they're picked up by people like the Lens blog at the New York Times, which pushes the story forward, which then also generates more work as well.
Mais Chavez, en insatiable meneur de foule, a réussi à conserver tout au long de ses mandats une popularité exceptionnelle.
Tonight, like every night in the first week at the festival, hundreds gather in an almost ritualistic projection of the year's news and pictures. Right now, it's the death of Hugo Chavez showing on a huge screen in front of the medieval Campo Santo Church. Thousands of images are flooding our screens, wires, and front pages. But who is making the editorial decisions? Back at the Palais, I meet a woman who should know.
My name is Claudia Zels. I'm the president of the French Photo Researcher Association, ANI, Association Nationale des Iconographes. Our main objective is to defend our profession, which has a huge crisis for several years already. It is a bit paradox, actually, because in the time of the internet and when all the amateurs came on the photo market, there is still a huge demand for pictures. But the professional photo editors have less and less jobs. I hear this very often and see this very often. We have a lot of freelance photo editors who have more and more difficulty finding employment or finding missions. That is really very clear. There are statistics about this, that we have less and less work, which is strange because there's such a big need for pictures. Websites, iPad structures, they still don't employ photo editors. They have the photo research and the purchasing of photos done by webmasters, by their journalists, by their graphists even. They still don't think about us. So we have a great interest in communicating that we exist, that there are people who are very competent in photography and could do this job very well.
Too much demand, too many photographers, and not nearly enough editors. And throw in the fact that being a photojournalist is often a badly paid and sometimes deadly business. One can only ask why anyone would ever do it. At another convent, a Palestinian photographer who is never far away from conflict tries to explain.
Physically and psychologically, you're ready that you're going to a war zone and expect everything. But besides that, you have the material stuff which you have to be already aware of. For example, the protective gears, the helmet, the flak jackets, the expenses in case you need a fixer, you need transportations. You need to arrange people on the ground to help you. So it's a big, big, big process. It's not just, I'm going to the war zone, I pick my camera and I go. First of all, I'm a photographer. It means it's something I love to do. It's part of me, it's my passion, it's my life. Photography is my life. It happened to be a photojournalist. So I don't want to call it an addiction. it's some kind of irresponsibility. Part of you feels responsible to cover a story. If I'm not in the war, I'm going to miss my war. And if I miss my war, I'm not going to forgive myself, but I know there will be another war. I'm born and raised in Jerusalem. I was raised with the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So this is where I found myself taking pictures. I have a degree in journalism and political science. I'm supposed to be writing, but actually my picture is my article. And all the stories that we are covering, we are not forced to go there. We are going there with all our conscience. It's part of you. The war is part of you, as life is part of you.
The passion felt for the profession is palpable at the festival. And despite concerns, that goes for the business side of the industry too. Back to Hugh Pinney of Getty Images.
I've never been one to buy into the doom stories about our industry, and I think actually that as technology evolves, as publishing evolves, the ability and the art of storytelling in pictures needs to evolve with it. And I think, and it is, and I think we're seeing more and more different media coming into play. I think you're seeing more and more avenues for photographers to actually have their work published and put their work into the public domain. And there are more and more photographers. I think the number of photographers has, you know, overall has increased. Or otherwise, say, I think the number of good photographers has increased. I would say I think perhaps the number of great photographers still remains pretty constant. And I think when you come somewhere like this, you start to be able to analyze that little extra something that does separate a good photographer from a great one.
At the end of the night, the projection ends with a minute vigil for the two French photographers who are missing, feared dead in Syria, Didier François and Edouard Elias. Precarious as a profession and a business it might be, but at Visa pour l'Image, the photojournalism industry shows just how vital and dynamic it still is. For Monocle, in Perpignan, I'm David Pleasant.
Stuart, it's interesting to hear Mr. Pinney from Getty Images. Not think there's much of a crisis, and I guess you can sort of feel like that when you have a bit of a monopoly as well on images as well. Are we moving into a situation that it becomes the preserve of Al Jazeera getting better positions, being more well oiled? I guess there's two points to this question. I mean, one, is it a changing landscape in terms of who the big players are going to be, and will there be fewer of them? Who can really, I guess, get their people out there and cover them properly?
There have always been powerful photo agencies, mostly based in Paris, actually, rather than in London. But the rise and rise of Getty Images is an extraordinary story. Now, because the oddity of the online world is that you can view Getty Images material online as a consumer. Mm. So if you want to look at the latest ray of pictures from a certain... It's the question that comes back. There's a really good point that was made about editing. I mean, if you've got the time, as some of us has, to actually go through these images... But if I look, for instance, The Guardian's daily offering on their iPad, actually, I find that a little bit disappointing. I kind of think, surely there must be some better images than that available. You know, how many sort of festivals in India do I need to look at, or sort of, struggling villages in places? I'd want to see more range of photographs. And I kind of sense they're out there. But I take that point that actually somebody's got to find them, choose them, select them, present them.
Mm. Robert, if we take it beyond even the photo agency, it was interesting to listen to you earlier when you were referencing, having, the Corriere and this international sort of band of correspondents that used to be out there. Is it just going to be, potentially the New York Times and maybe sort of, the odd Japanese newspaper that will be, right in there in the thick of it? And I say in the thick of it, being able to ensure their correspondents, make sure that they're well and truly looked after, or will it be a broader field?
It's the looking after and the risk. You're absolutely right. The benchmark now is the New York Times. It's barely even Reuters in terms of reporting from the ground. It was always Reuters. And then the BBC did very well in getting in on the Reuters ethos. You look at the way that the Britain is going... I'm amazed, sorry, and I think it is the effect of iPad and the apps. The Financial Times is no longer what it was under Freddie Fisher. It doesn't want to do the global context. And because it's thinned down that, it doesn't know, okay, I'm a bit up the old persiflage end of the thing. I was about to say old fart, so I'll say it. But you just... But the level of commentary really is not as good as it was 10 years ago, whether it's on Syria, whether it's on Fukushima. And that's the thing that worries me. And I think that it's a much bigger thing that you and Stuart are really talking about. It is the value of this commodity called news. The commercial world doesn't like it very much. Let's be very careful about it. But human nature absolutely loves it. It is part of gossip, rumor, information. It's the way we work as human beings. And there is a new conceptualization of news coming in, and it is not just owned by the big boys. And some of the big boys, like the BBC, I think, are in shock, even Sky, because we're getting new players, BT, Amazon coming in. But it is actually, it's the singer and the song, and great storytelling, which is what great news reporting can and really should be. The Rajad Kapuscinskis, the Vasily Grossmans, the Ed Murrows, George Lowther Steer, who really did cross the line, you know, who did reported Guernica. Yes, that tradition is as strong as ever. I think that people will go out and do that because it's not just money and it's not just fame. There's a sheer bloody-mindedness of curiosity that drives you.
Which is good, dear gentlemen. We're going to have to leave it there. Stuart Purvis, the new book, When Reporters Cross the Line, out by Back. And it came out on newsstands on Thursday. And Robert Fox, thank you very, very much for joining us. That's all for today's program. It's been produced by Katie Bilboa and David Pleasant. Also behind the glass today is the lovely Claire Urban. And also thanks to our researcher as well, Matt Alagaya. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, back next Saturday. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, until next time, it's goodbye. News is next.